My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hi, I'm Essie Moadi, founding partner of Mighty Capital, and I'm excited to host this series on the age of product. Let's hear from my guest today.
Renee, it's great to catch up, and I'm really looking forward to this interview. Why don't we start with you introducing yourself?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to join you. I've been looking forward to this. By way of introduction, I guess I can best be described as a lifelong connoisseur for great products to make a difference in people's lives. I've spent the last 30 years as the top product and business leader for, frankly, and humbly, some of the best companies in the world, including Logitech, Plantronics, and Google. I've led the teams primarily at the intersection of computing and mobility, and safe to say I've been doing this long enough that I think I may have been one of the very first chief product officers around, certainly in technology. So I've seen a lot of evolution. So I'm super excited to be here.
Well, Renee, it's great to have you, and you're obviously a pioneer. Full disclosure, you're also an LP in Mighty Capital. Let me start with my first question. And I want to go back. You mentioned one of the first CPOs in the world. So as we emerge from this pandemic, we have seen a massive acceleration of digital transformations. And that's not just in technology, that's across all industries. We said 2020 has been a dog year, maybe 2021 will be one too. So 7 years of digital transformation in one or two. And really we're seeing the dawn of an era that we call the age of product, where the best product wins. And so it's really a situation where great products, great customer experiences, trumps massive distribution, trumps free. And we've seen massive industries, we've seen massive enterprises create this CPO role across industries. It really looks like the creation of the CMO, Chief Marketing Officer role, about a decade ago. And I'm curious to hear from you how you see that role take shape, and how can chief product officers and have chief product officers establish their credibility in the C-suite?
Yeah, so that's a great question and one that's near and dear to my heart. So just to not bore you with a long history, but if you take a step back, and even as short as 10 years ago, the way chief product officers and product teams across the board really went around to create products was literally, especially in the enterprise, was literally customer to customer. So, the best product managers and product leaders were the ones that had the strongest voice of the customer kind of ringing in their head, and they could marry that with technology and, a vision for customer experience and create great products. And to be honest, we delivered some really good products that way. The challenge was when you would bring the roadmap and the ever contentious roadmap to the C-suite, there was always this debate. Well, you saw 5 customers, I've seen 10 customers, says the salesperson, and therefore we need, XYZ feature, and you know, my 10 customers, your 5 customers. And so it would literally end up in this really tough debate where the often the product team would lose and would have to go, and the urgent would overtake the long-term important. By the way, at the cost of the company in the long-term innovation and business proposition. So fast forward to the last few years where everything is connected, and we are able to, in the age of big data and analytics, we're actually able to convert which was just a simple customer opinion and actually look at usage. We can look at the details on what price points they buy at and when they buy and the time they buy and the why they buy and the how they use. And we can take all this data now. So when we're faced with a decision of what products to bring to market, we're not just, you know, informed by the anecdotes, we're now informed by the data. So when you bring that to the C-suite, the conversation changes dramatically, and it's less about, you know, what is the right product, but the conversation is now what is really around what's the right business for the future. And that's really been, you know, a material shift in the role of the CPO.
That's really interesting, Renee. And it's, you know, the image that I have in my head when you share that is we used to be in the Mad Men era, right? Like it's all about creativity and instincts and possibilities. And now we're in the maybe the mass men era, or I should say mass women, since you and I are having this conversation. And I love this, you know, this transformation, right? Where does power come from? It comes from knowledge, from data, from analytics. And you know, I was mentioning earlier, we see that these companies that are putting data first, that are putting product first, they're actually able to innovate and win against the, you know, big monopolies. Zoom, for example, was a clear winner in the pandemic, right? Winning against Microsoft Teams and a bunch of other very, very large players because they have a stronger product. Amplitude in the portfolio of Mighty Capital was able to win market shares against Google Analytics. So you're a product visionary, obviously. You're also an investor, and I would be really interested to hear why you think investing in the best product is a winning strategy or not. It's totally cool if you're, you know, to have disagreements and make the conversation richer.
Yeah, so it would be irony for me to say that it wasn't that the best product wins. So absolutely, but you have to define what the best product means. When I look at what the best product is it's the solving for the right problem with a clear customer who has that problem at a price and an experience that's delightful, right? And when you think about the age of digital and the role that products are playing in this age of digital, it's not just about the gadget or the nice to have. It now becomes kind of a fundamental foundation for business growth. And so having these products solving problems at all different levels in the enterprise is really, really critical. So that's the first point. I would add to that you can have that great product, but you need that great product needs to be supported by an amazing team that is flexible, that has a growth mindset, that is constantly worrying about what's next and how and when to pivot your strategy so that you don't get, I always use the term Ubered, but so you don't become that taxi cab of the past competing with the Ubers of the future. So best product with a great team. And then I think that, you know, certainly even as an investor, you know, making sure that you have a really solid view on how to communicate that product and how to bring that product to market. And we often refer to that, you know, as the go-to-market strategy, but you need all three elements to have a successful business.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the team, the product, and the business strategy. And I know you're advising CEOs. We'd love to get a story about your favorite CEO, how you met them, how you earned their trust, and how your background as a CPO has influenced your relationship with them.
Yeah, so probably the best CEO story I have is one that I've known for years and that I worked with for years. It was at Plantronics, and the CEO at Plantronics, you know, his background was an investment banker, so he was really, really comfortable with numbers, super strong relationship person. You know, he knew every single one of our partners and their wives or husbands' names and how many children they had and what school they went to, right? So he was super strong on the sales side and super strong. So here I come as, you know, at the time, I didn't start as the chief product officer. I come to, you know, run a consumer products business. And he's like, you know, how do you establish credibility with, you know, this, you know, product visionary with someone who thinks customers and numbers first? And, you know, the first step that I had to take honestly was, you know, talk his language. And the best way to do that, A, was to have a good business model that you say, okay, this is what we can afford on, you know, everything from, you know, product development costs to marketing and go to market, but also having a really solid understanding and clarity on the customer and the customer problems to solve, a really kind of, how do I say this? It built that bridge of understanding. Then that's when magic happened, because what we were able to do is paint this vision for the future. Now, this was a few years ago before the iPhone was even announced. I'm probably aging myself. And so we had this vision for mobility and how, you know, mobility was going to kind of take over the world, which I say now sounds obvious. At the time, it wasn't so obvious. And being able to marry that vision with the growth and the implications to the customers and the numbers really helped kind of cement that relationship with him. Now you realize he's the CEO. CEOs and what they're under pressure are, you know, not what the next cool product is. They need to deliver consistent growth for their shareholders. They need to make sure that they have happy, long-lasting customers. These are the things that they care about. So truly, to be able to kind of, you know, take my innovation and creativity and cool ideas on design and marry them with business was really the secret sauce to developing that relationship. And by the way, he called me this morning. So years and years down the road, we still keep in touch.
That's awesome. Yes, and what you're describing is really earning a spot in the on the C-suite table is really saying the work that my team does matters. Not just because it's work, but because it moves the needle, right? It moves revenue, it moves margin, it moves stock price, market share, some of the top line indicators.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to switch gears a little bit and go into more of the product visionary side of things. As investors and in this podcast, we always try to predict the future because we're looking at how great investors think and win. And so I'm really interested to hear your perspective as a visionary. What do you see happening in the next decade? And you can pick any trend. I'm really more looking to have a creative conversation about, you know, innovation, future of work, digital health, which I know are things you're really passionate about, or some other area.
Yeah, absolutely. So I really focus, I think there are three things. And if you had talked to me 2 years ago, I would have been focused on the first two. So let me walk you through them. So the first is when you look at big data, AI, wearable computing, connected computing, there is an absolute revolution that is going to happen in healthcare. And why? Get back to that big kind of, you know, problem statement. When you look at our healthcare system, you know, and as the baby boomers are aging, that they are going to absolutely overwhelm the healthcare system. And so what I really believe is going to be one of the most massive changes in the next 10 years on how healthcare is going to be fundamentally revolutionized, where we're going to be able to predict illness from your home. What are the benefits to predicting the illness? Well, the benefit is the fact that you can get in front of it and solve it before it's a, when it's a small problem, before it's a huge problem, as an example. We are going to realize that there are a lot of maintenance, healthcare maintenance that can be done and should be done in the comfort of your own home versus, you know, in a doctor's office. Let's just, you know, to be honest, doctor's offices are filled with germs and disease. And yes, some of this seems really, you know, obvious now because of the pandemic, but I think the pandemic has just underscored and brought to the top of the visibility, the problem statement of what we're faced with. I just think we're at this amazing, unique intersection in time and need where I think the next 10 years in healthcare and is going to be absolutely turned upside down, and it will not look the same in 10 years as it does today. That's the first one. And you can tell I'm very passionate about that one.
That's a big one.
It is a big one. The second one that I really believe in, and I think we're literally just at the tip of the iceberg in terms of its potential, is around the notion of blockchain and the value that it brings to trust and security for the future. And I know a lot of investors in, you know, frankly, people that I talk to on a day-to-day basis think of blockchain as a technology for digital currency. And yes, it is a technology for digital currency. However, blockchain is a fundamental way that you can establish trust in a secure manner that will transform the way we invest in the future, the way we buy a home in the future, the way we bank in the future, the way we buy insurance in the future. It's really a disruptive, by the way, much needed technology that will really change some of these fundamental industries moving forward. So that's definitely one that's very much front and center on the radar. And then I think the third one is all about this disaggregation of the workforce. This was happening slowly before the pandemic, and technologies to support that, such as, you know, video conferencing, We're very slowly, you know, we're talking, you know, single digit growth, maybe on a good year, double digit growth a year, gaining traction. But literally overnight, one of the interesting changes of the pandemic is it forced us to do what was uncomfortable, which is to really, you know, to actually work from home using technologies like video conferencing. And you know, I predict that a percentage of the world will probably go back to normal, but a big percentage of the world will not. And I think it's going to create opportunities and challenges moving forward. And whenever there's big opportunities and big challenges, there's going to be the need and the opportunity to use technology to solve them. And I'll just use one quick example and then I'll pause. So one really quick example is, and we're going to see this very quickly as the economy starts opening up, there will be those who are comfortable going back into the office. And then there's going to be those who are still uncomfortable or cannot, for a variety of reasons, go back into the office. So you're going to have this hybrid work environment. And what that does in terms of efficiency, in terms of communications, and the ability to actually be productive is going to be very disruptive. And I think that we're very close to being able to see that problem statement. I haven't seen the solution to that problem statement, but I just use that as kind of an example of where there is big problems to solve for them. But I think that this is going to be our future. And I think that over the next even 3 to 5 years, that we're going to start to see a lot of startups and innovators try to solve for that problem.
Yeah, there's going to be a long-term impact. That's TBD. Renee, we're reaching the end of our interview, and I have 3 questions that I'm going to ask you in a more of a lightning strike fashion. Okay. We have time, but it's a little bit more lightning strike. So my first question is, what makes a great VC investor?
I think it comes down to your experience, but I think the best investors that I've seen, the most successful ones, have a mix of good people instincts, solid business knowledge, so across the business functions, and the third piece is really a very clear vision for the future.
Great, super, super crisp. I love it. Let me ask you any advice you have for our audience, VC investors, innovators who want to be visionaries like you, see the future.
You know, for investors, I had a really good teacher once that taught me that, you can teach if you've got a big problem and a bad team, or let me rephrase that. If you have a bad product and a good team, you can fix the product. If you have a good product, but a bad team, the product will fail. And my point here is, even though products are critical, teams and investing in great teams is really where the secret sauce is to success. So you don't want to just get the great product. You really focus on investing in a really good team is my best advice for investors.
Awesome. Yeah, team is first, people. And then really last question I have for you is about ways that you stay sharp as a visionary. Right, innovation is constantly running ahead. So what are some of the podcasts, books, people that inspire you?
I'm sure you're expecting some kind of like brilliant technology Bible, and there really isn't one. I literally am reading all the time, and I think multiple perspectives is healthy. Where I invest my time, again, I believe people is the success and the center of success in everything we do. So I really spend my time more on the people side. And the two thought leaders that I follow religiously, one is Brené Brown. If you don't know her, I really recommend you can start with her TED Talk from a while back ago. But she's a clinical psychologist that really studied the power of vulnerability, and it has been a game changer. And she's constantly rethinking, how you show up in both your work and your personal life and the impact that that can have on your success. So I really suggest Brené Brown. And the second is Simon Sinek. He's, you know, a typical business writer, but he really focuses on the motivation behind the business as opposed to, you know, the nuts and bolts of the business. You know, his famous book that I love is really The Power of Why, and why you do what you do, and understanding that and leading with why. So those are my two big inspirers.
That's awesome. And definitely focused on people. Believe it or not, it's actually not uncommon for innovators to say there is no book. By the time the book is out, it's outdated. I rely on people. And so your point about people coming first is well taken. Renee, anything else you'd like to share with us today?
No, I just want to thank you for the opportunity. It's been a lot of fun, and I'm really, you know, grateful and honored to have spent the time with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and it's also an honor to learn from you. Thank you very much, and until soon.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.